This is a No Dharma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by Dylan Beattie from Forest Hill in London. Thank you very much for taking time out of your Saturday, Dylan.
Hey, no problem. How are you doing?
Very well. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself to start off, please?
My name's Dylan Beattie. I normally say I'm a developer, musician, conference speaker. I've been writing code since I was, 7 years old. Whenever the Amstrad 6128 came out, since then, that was my first machine. I've been building web applications since the earliest days of the web. Nowadays I build data-driven stuff. I work on a combination of .NET. My day job at the moment is with a company in London called Skills Matter, who organize a whole bunch of conferences and training courses and a lot of stuff in the developer community, which is, you know, something I'm very passionate about. And alongside that, I travel around the world. I give talks about software, about hypermedia APIs, about development culture. I write parody songs about software development. And quite often when I get invited to conferences, they'll ask me to bring my guitar and we'll get up on stage and have some fun. And I meet people at conferences and they say, hey, can you come and do an episode of my podcast? And I say yes, because I'm incapable of saying no to things. And so here we are.
Indeed. And it's rare that I hear of Amstrad computers. So my very first computer was an Amstrad 464. But it sounds like yours had 128K.
It did indeed. And a disk drive.
I was going to say,
it was a 3-inch disk, not 3.5, 3. Oh. And the first batch of them, they got a job lot of these 3-inch drives. So the story goes, there was a load of remaindered stock in a factory in Taiwan or China somewhere. And Amstrad bought them all and put them in the CPC 6128, and then realized that no other computer in the world used a 3-inch disk drive, and they were basically on a dead end for their entire product line. Even about 10 years later, there were still people going, how do I get the files off my old Amstrad onto like anything? Because, you know, no Wi-Fi, no network ports. They had a parallel port for like a daisy wheel printer. So, that was an interesting quirk. And that's what I did my first basic and logo programming on, was an Amstrad 6128.
Yeah, Amstrads were popular in both Britain and Ireland, but I don't think they made it over to the US.
They were sold in mainland Europe under a different brand. They were called Schneider, certainly in France and in Germany. But I don't think they ever made it out of Europe.
Yeah, and then
so Alan Sugar, the guy, the AMS in Amstrad, he was when they brought the Apprentice to the UK, he's the guy they found to do it. So that probably tells you everything you need to know about his, you know, scope and vision, and you know, very, very successful businessman for a certain definition of successful.
He was a football team owner too, I think, wasn't he? Mm-hmm. I don't know which.
Yeah, he owns. I think it's Tottenham Hotspur.
Okay.
He was apparently a fan growing up because he comes from Tottenham, and then he got rich enough to buy the team. So, which must have been a nice day for him.
Yeah. What we're talking about isn't completely out of context for what we're going to talk about in the rest of the podcast. We're going to talk about programming and why some people, including yourself, perhaps consider it an art. So can you give us an introduction to that, please?
So that's an interesting sentence to start with, programming considered as an art, because, you know, probably the most famous example of this is Donald Knuth, who wrote I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, K-N-U-T-H. He's the guy who wrote The Art of Computer Programming, which was this sort of 5-volume magnum opus about algorithms and data structures. And he actually, at one point, he was so upset with the typesetting for the book that he took a decade off and he invented LaTeX, or invented tech, which became LaTeX, just so he could get the pages to look right for his book. And then he went back to it. The books are called The Art of Computer Programming, volume 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. But actually, they are about the science of computer programming, because they are very, very much books of algorithmic recipes and solutions and data structures, and, you know, an attempt to formalize a lot of the rigor and discipline around how you design and create computer software. But there's a lot of discussion, you know, I think there always has been, about is computer programming, is it an engineering discipline? Is it like manufacturing? Is it an art form? Is there, you know, this whole notion of software craft and the software craft movement and stuff? And these are ideas that, you know, I've played around a lot, because I definitely believe even, you know, code which is not exciting, like code which does invoices for investment banks or something, you can look at different examples of that kind of code, and some of it has an artistry about it. Some of it, there is a sort of an elegance and a creativity to the way that it's been created, whereas other code, it solves the same problem and probably for a comparable cost, but it's a mess. It's just unpleasant to look at and it's difficult to read. And so, you know, I do think that there is a very valid discussion to be had about the role of elegance and artistry in, shall we say, industrial programming. But what I'm more interested in talking about today is programming for the sake of programming. You know, this whole thing about, you know, what is the purpose of art? Well, actually, art is the stuff which doesn't have a point. It doesn't solve a problem. It's just, it's expressive, it's creative, it's the stuff people do to entertain and express themselves and stop them getting bored. And I'm at the moment very interested in that kind of interpretation of art, but using computer programming and computer software as a way of expressing things. You know, programs that were written for fun by somebody who enjoyed writing them and wanted to share them just to make people laugh, or, you know, make people think, or just to kind of, you know, explore what was possible here. And so, you know, there's this whole broad spectrum, which we'll talk about in the course of the show today. But yeah, that's the thing I'm interested in. It's programs that don't have to do anything, programs that just exist because they are supposed to, you know, bring laughter or joy or happiness or just, you know, entertain people.
Where did this where would you say this idea started? Because obviously you're referring to the book, but did that book propose programming as art for the sake of art, or did it propose it as art for the sake of solving problems?
So I must confess, I've not read the book. I've sort of flicked through it and remember it being very heavy and very dense. And it's on my list of things that I think everybody should do and I'll get around to one day. But, you know, I think the... certainly my own experience, and I think this is probably true of a lot of programmers, when you get hold of a piece of technology like the Amstrad I was talking about in the intro there, my first thing is, what can I make it do? And I'm not, you know, I didn't have like a real world problem that I wanted to solve. You know, I was 7 years old. But I was like, I maybe the problem was I want to play games and I don't have any. I wonder if I can make my own games. And, you know, Logo, which was the one of the first programming languages I ever used. It's a little bit kind of out of fashion now, but in the 80s, Logo was massive in education. And basically, it's a procedural language where you have a thing called a turtle, which in my case was on a screen. But a lot of schools, they actually had a turtle, which was a little thing with wheels that would run around the floor with a pen stuck in it and would draw shapes on big bits of paper. And so you'd have instructions like, you know, repeat four, forward 10, left 90, and you'd draw a little square. And of course, that was it. You'd draw a square. Well done. You got a square. And then you switch the computer off and it all goes away because, you know, you're not solving anything. But I loved what you could do with Logo. I love this idea of you know, what if I go forward and then I go right, and how do I draw pentagons, and how do I draw like spirograph shapes? And, you know, you could do some really, and they were beautiful. You know, this was, you draw some really, really sophisticated geometric shapes and stuff. But it had no point. You know, it solved no problem. No one would ever pay to run the software that was being created. You just did it. And, you know, occasionally if something was really good, I would print it out and, you know, my folks would stick it on the fridge or something. But that was just, you know, it's you exploring how you can use a computer just to express an idea or see if something is possible. So that's my own experience. And I think that sort of curiosity has been there since the earliest programmable computers. You know, there's ideas. There's a guy called John Conway, who was a mathematician, came up with this thing called Conway's Game of Life. You ever come across this? It's a grid of cells that switch on and off. And the rules are something like if a cell is, if it's got less than one neighbor, it dies of loneliness. And if it's got more than four, it dies of overcrowding. And if a dead cell has got three neighbors, they bring it back to life in the next iteration. And so you start this thing off and you just get these funny little patterns of lights kind of flicking across the screen. And then you start playing around with it and you realize you can create these kind of stable repeating patterns. And, you know, Conway's Game of Life now, there are people who've spent a huge amount of time doing research and investigation on what's possible just using these three very, very simple rules and this grid of cells. You know, you want to go and it doesn't work well on a podcast because it's very visual, but go onto YouTube and look for something called a glider gun. And there are these wonderful formations which kind of they generate signals, like little signals gliding across the screen. And then people have built logic gates and all this kind of stuff. But you know, if you need to build a program to solve a problem, there's no way you're going to do it in Conway's Game of Life, because it's, you know, we have better solutions for this. But it's fun. It's lots of fun. And it's fun seeing what you can do with it. And it's also fun seeing what other people have been able to do with it. And I think that, you know, Conway is probably the earliest example of this idea of writing programs as art. And then, you know, kind of sharing the output of that with other people who then look at it and you know, just appreciate it. But there's also, I think, a subtle distinction between, you know, programs which are written to create some kind of output which is artistic. Because these days, you know, that covers everything coming out of Hollywood. You go and see the new Avengers movie, and there's so much code running to make those characters and scenes and, you know, that tell that story. And so the movie is the art, and there's a lot of code that goes into making that happen. But, you know, no one's looking at the code and going, oh, wow, this is beautiful. They're watching the movie and going, wow, he ripped his head completely off or something. And so I'm interested in code which is kind of art in its own self. Like, you're sharing the source code and people are looking at it and going, wow, this is really, you know, fascinating or interesting or spectacular. Or just often, I had no idea this kind of thing was even possible. And so it kind of, just to play with this idea of chronology a little bit, there's a thing in the early 80s, the demo scene. You ever heard of this?
Yeah, after the Amstrad, I got an Amiga something. I can't think it was 1200, and you'd buy these magazines, paper magazines, in the newsagent, and it'd come with discs. And yeah, sometimes they would have a demo. And what I think what you're referring to is a sort of 4K or 16K thing, yeah, which you explain it, because I don't remember, and I know you this is more your area.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things that, at the time, it was astonishing, because, you know, nowadays you go on a YouTube, you find anything, double click, and you've got full screen, high definition video with stereo sound in color. And, you know, it's very difficult now to remember what it was like when every computer you'd ever seen in your life was a black and white text display. And then someone got one to display a picture and you were like, wow, I didn't know they could do that. And then, you know, we got sort of initially four colors, then 16 colors, then 256 colors. And the demo scene were developers who were often, you know, working right at the lowest level, like writing microcode instructions directly into the specialist chips that these things had. So a lot of them, like the Atari and the Amiga, they had specialist chips for doing audio. They had a specialist chip for doing sprites. They had I think it was the Amiga had a thing called a copper chip, which was for rendering gradients. And so these copper bars, these kind of shiny metal sliding bars, were a recurring feature of the Amiga demo scene. And everyone called them copper bars because it was the copper processor that made them possible. And it was competitive, because the other thing that you sort of forget is that the Atari, the Atari 520 and the Amiga 500, those were on the market for 3 or 4 years and they didn't change. It's not like today where there's a new iPhone every 6 months and, you know, new MacBooks and new things. And, you know, if the code's too slow, you just wait because there'll be a faster computer next year. You bought an Amiga and that was like an investment for 3 or 4 years and it wasn't going to get upgraded. And so people really took the time to understand every nuance, every detail. They knew tricks to, you know, get the display to run in modes that the manufacturers never intended by overclock this and poke this instruction in here. And you could get, you know, more colors, you could get more pixels, you could get all kinds of things out of these systems, which the creators never intended. And the demo scene people are like, right, what can we do with it? You know, I remember demos. I was on the IBM PC in the early 90s, which had a speaker that went beep. And somebody worked out how to get it to play 16-bit sampled sound. And it was so quiet, I actually took the PC apart and I wired up an amplifier to the PC speaker just so I could hear this thing. I put a headphone jack on the front of it. And I just, you know, the entire industry is going, IBM PCs have crap sound, they can only go beep. And then one cover disc of a magazine is like, well, actually, we're going to play a mod file with four independent tracker modules running with, you know, bass and drums and synthesizers. And I'm like, how is everyone not doing this? And the answer is it's really, really hard. Like, you know, next level stuff in terms of the understanding of the hardware that you need to do it. But these people were doing it. And there was a sort of very friendly, competitive thing about what can we make these computers do? Can we get them to play cartoons, animations, video, you know, 3D, stuff that just people hadn't seen before? And of course, that pushes the boundary of everybody's perception of the capabilities of the technology. And then people like game studios were normally the next generation who would then go back to work from one of the big demo meetups, demo cons, and be like, this is possible. I know it's possible. Find out how we do it. We're going to put it in our next game. We can do better sound. We can do, and then that, you know, pushes the state of the art. And I think, you know, historically gaming has always pushed the hardware and the platform manufacturers harder, because gamers are the ones who are like, it's still not fast enough. I need more bandwidth. I need lower ping times. I need more high definition. I want better sound effects. Make everything better. I want to be able to simulate reality in real time so well I can't tell the difference, and do that for 64 people all connected to the same server at once. Which, you know, for all the amazing innovations in modern technology, we're not even close to simulating reality to that fidelity yet. And so the gamers are pushing, going, come on, still not good enough, still not good enough. And the rest of us kind of ride along in that wake, going, all right, faster chips, better laptops, better batteries, better phones, all this kind of stuff. What can we do with it now? And so that was the kind of, you know, the whole demo scene thing. And that, you know, it's sort of, I mentioned the Avengers movie and Hollywood and stuff. We've kind of got to the point now where if you have time, you can use a computer to recreate just about anything. You know, any music can be synthesized, any visual pictures. There's this stuff now with deep fake algorithms and people putting Barack Obama's face on someone else's body and it looks like he's giving a press conference. And so, you know, the kind of, wow, look what we made the computer do, is it's not real time yet, but it kind of feels like it's on the cusp of being a solved problem. Like, yeah, whatever. You can imagine it. We can make a computer do it. And so now the thing that is interesting to me is, how do you surprise people when that's already there? How can you take something like a piece of code or something and show it to somebody and they look at it and they're like, I don't understand this. And they dig a little harder and they're like, oh, wow, is that really doing what I think it's doing? And of course, you know, the when anything's solvable, just what run on a screen isn't that impressive anymore, which is where we get into this idea of, you know, code as a form of art, software project, you know, source code files as something that people look at in their own right and go, is this really kind of doing what I think it's doing? So you ever heard of a thing that there was a thing called Code Golf, which is... So Code Golf is, they give you a problem and you've got to solve it using the smallest number of keystrokes, like the smallest number of characters. Like, what is the tiniest program you can come up with to do something like print the Fibonacci sequence? There's a Stack Overflow or something for Code Golf. But it's one of these kind of art forms. Once you understand a language really well and you know all the tricks, and, you know, there's some fun stuff you can do with, there's a lot of stuff you can do with obfuscated JavaScript, for example, because JavaScript's dynamically typed, which means if you can work out a way of building a string that contains the program you want, you can then turn that string into code and you can run it directly by pushing it through something like eval. And lots of things in JavaScript turn into strings if you poke them in the wrong way. So you can take an empty array, which is two square brackets, and you can stick one of those plus empty array, and that'll give you a number, and then you can coerce the number into another thing. And like, if you divide by zero in JavaScript, you get nan, N-A-N, not a number. But then you can turn that into a string and stick it on other things. And people just abusing the language to get laughs and see what's possible with it. And Code Golf is kind of the opposite. It's like, instead of how weird and obfuscated can we make this, by building these long, long programs out of very minimal sets of instructions, Code Golf is like, all right, you can use anything in the language. What's the smallest number of characters you can do? And, you know, there's people who've like done a, I remember seeing when it rendered the Mandelbrot set, that famous fractal, in a text mode display using ASCII art to render the bits of the fractal. And it did it it fit inside someone's email signature. So it was four lines of less than 72 characters each that you pasted and ran in a shell. And it was, I think it was a C program that would render the Mandelbrot set. And, you know, And people look at that and they're like, what is this massive noise at the end of this person's email? And then you like you see who the email's from and you ping them back. You're like, what's your email signature? They're like, run it and see if you trust me. And you run it and you're like, oh my word, that is astonishing. And, you know, things like a real-time clock in two lines of Perl code that you have no idea what it does, then you run it and it turns your desktop into this ASCII ticking clock display and stuff. And, you know, they're pointless. Nobody is ever going, I hope, nobody is ever going to use one of these as part of a business system or, you know, providing services or anything real people are paying money for. But they're fun and they're interesting. And when you see them, you know, certain kinds of people, and I think a lot of developers fall into this category, you see it and you think, I wonder if I can do that. I wonder what happens if I poke this and poke that. And so, you know, there's CodeGoth, there's a thing called the Obfuscated C contest, which is kind of very similar, which is that the idea is to make a program as unreadable as possible while still having it run and do something surprising when you run it, like display a kind of a globe of the Earth that orbits inside a text window and something. I think if that's the one I'm thinking of, the source code actually looked like a map of the world. They put tabs and spaces to indent everything so it looked like a map, and then you run it and it draws a map. So there's this whole thing about let's write code that will show to other people who are coders and see if we can, you know, surprise them or impress them or get a laugh out of them or something. And so that's this whole idea of what if the source code was an art form in its own right? You know, what if there was an art, not what happens when you run it, but also how is it constructed? You know, what does it look like?
A few months back when we met, you also mentioned a thing called quines. Can you explain that one, please?
So a quine is a program that prints its own source code. So think about that just for a second. Let it sink in. Take, you know, pretty much any program you've ever written, and there'll be a bunch of, you know, hash include and boilerplate and public static void main bracket something, and then printf or console.writeline. You get one line of output, and you're like, okay, well, hang on, how do I get my program to print the hash include standard IO and the public static void? So you paste that and then you're like, well, no, now the program's twice as long and it's printing its old source code, but now the program's got bigger, so how do I print that? And so quines are these beautifully elegant little puzzle boxes of programs that effectively they work out a way of compressing the entire program into the output that's created by its own source. So when you run a quine, you get your program back out and then you can run it again and you can run it again. And there are some, you know, neat little elegant tricks and stuff. By the way, the thing where you just get the program to read its own source code and print that is considered cheating and that is not allowed. You have to actually build the program from strings and things. And, you know, there's lots of quines out there for languages like C and Java, JavaScript, all these kinds of things. And there's a guy called Leon Bambrick has created an HTML quine, which is just staggeringly wonderful. Because you think about it, you know, basic web page, you have at the top doctype HTML, which you don't see. And then you've got HTML inside angle brackets, which you don't see. And then you've got head and title. And then there's a little piece of text which shows up in your browser, you know, window, Chrome, whatever. And then when you get to body, then it gets to the stuff you can see. But of course, there's all these tags, the H1 and the P and the href and all this kind of stuff, which are all invisible. So if you paste a web page into like a text editor and save it, what you get is just the text, the plain text output. And what Leon worked out how to do is have a web page that uses some really clever CSS rules to take all of the angle brackets and the tags and the markup and everything and actually display that in the browser so that this web page, you copy it and paste it and open it in a browser and it re-renders itself exactly the same as it was the first time around. And, you know, this thing was just fantastic. This whole idea of, you know, code that makes you go, wow, that is so cool. I wonder how it works. This was a brilliant example of that. So check that out. It's a Leon Bambrick's HTML quine. If you Google it, you'll find it. And just take a minute to dig into that. And that, you know, I thought was such an interesting idea because it's using something we all take for granted. I've been building HTML since, I think, 1992. And if you'd said to me, can you make a web page that prints its own source code? I'd have said, no, that's probably impossible. Why? And, you know, but it plants that seed of, well, if this is possible, what else might we have got wrong? You know, and then the next level beyond this, there's a thing called a quine relay. And what a quine relay is let's say you have a program in C And when you run it, it outputs some source code in Fortran. And then you run the Fortran program, and it outputs the original program in C. And it goes round and round and round. And then someone says, well, what about if the C program emits Fortran, and the Fortran emitted, COBOL, and the COBOL emitted C? And then someone says, well, hang on, I think I've worked out a way that we can put Scheme in between C and COBOL. And, this has become, there's a small number of very, very smart people who are spending a lot of time and apparently having a lot of fun from the look of it in building these quine relays and trying to work out what is the longest chain of languages that you can kind of flow through from one to the next to the next to the next. So yeah, there's a bunch of people out there making these quine relays, and I think the record at the moment, there's a guy called I assume it's a guy, Yosuke Endo, could be a woman, I don't know, has created a 128 language quine relay. It's a Ruby program that produces a Rust program that produces a Scala program, which produces a Scheme program, and 124 languages later, it gets back to Ruby, and you know that that's mind blowing. Like, imagine you put the effort in to understand the nuance of these languages to the extent that makes something like that possible. Something we were chatting about a little while ago is these, you know, programming as art is pointless. You do it because it's fun and, you know, you want to say, hey, look what I did and entertain people and stuff. But actually in the process of doing that, you learn a huge amount about the limitations of the material you're working with. You know, there's always been, since humans started building things, there's always been this tradition of, you know, carpenters would whittle little sculptures and things, partly for fun, but also to get a sense of, you know, how the material worked and how different kinds of timber respond to different, working techniques, different kinds of saw blades and glues and all this kind of stuff. And I think there's value in for us as technologists in doing the same thing, you know. It liberates you from worrying about what will happen if somebody wants to run this for real. Because a recurring headache I see in software is somebody builds a prototype to see if it's possible, and then the business turns around and goes, well, brilliant, we'll ship that. And you're like, don't ship that. That's not ready. It's not,
It works.
At that point, it works. Yeah, it solves the problem. Ship it. We're done. We'll repay the technical debt later. Whereas if, you know, if you have the, and I realize that time is something of a luxury for many of us, but if you have the time and you have the appetite to improve and you want to completely liberate yourself from, you know, the discipline, the rigor of, security and regression testing, unit tests, code reviews, all that kind of stuff. Play around with code that you know is going to get thrown away because it's pointless and do stuff with that. And, you know, write quines, write quine relays, play around with this kind of thing. Because it's an interesting way of teaching you things about the languages and platforms we work with that maybe, you know, we hadn't considered before, hadn't realized before. And it's fun, you know, it's a fun way to waste an afternoon.
No, I agree. I don't go into those particular types of avenues, but something I very much enjoy is writing simple programs and doing them a little bit better each time, or writing them in a way that someone else will understand them more easily. So I blog a lot, and I always try to make the code as easy to understand as possible and not make it complicated and take out all the weird things. But as I do that, what I'm realizing is I can bring the code down to the minimum. So I strip out all the things that you don't need, and I'm only using that one or two features. And then, of course, you have slightly more efficient code, you've got less error-prone code, and that turns into less testing when you want to do something a little more substantial.
The number of times I've gone to ask a question on Stack Overflow or file a support ticket with a vendor or something, I've been like, I should reduce this to the smallest possible reproduction case. And in doing that, I fixed my own problem.
Yeah.
And actually, it turns out there's nothing wrong there. It's just there was some complexity that was masking a bug that became obvious once you tried to eliminate the sort of indirection. Code is great, but when it comes to production, the less of it we run, the better. So
there's another thing I know you're very interested in, and it's the topic of esoteric languages. But before you
let's talk go about esolangs.
Let's All talk right, about what esoteric means first.
Esoteric is, I don't know, weird, quirky, unconventional. It's this sort of one of those English words I would struggle to define off the top of my head, but I'll know it when I see it. Something which is unusual for the sake of being unusual. Esoteric languages are often designed and created as a like a challenge. Somebody identifies a constraint and then they're like, all right, do you think it's possible to create a programming language within this constraint or this set of constraints? And, you know, constraint has always been a wonderful tool for inspiring creativity. The film director, Alfred Hitchcock, the rumor has it, you know, I've never met the man personally, but apparently, you know, at a certain point in his career, he was starting to get bored of just making movies. And people started, you know, his friends would bet him and they'd say things like, you know, do you think you can make a full length movie, a thriller that's just set in one room? Like, that's it. No changes of location. And of course, everyone knows Rear Window. It's this famous, you know, masterpiece of suspense filmmaking, which is all set in one room. It's this one guy who's, you know, he's confined to a room in his house and everything that happens, he sees out of this window. And then, you know, the one he made after that, someone said, all right, well done, Alfred. Nice work. Do you think you can make a film in one take? And there's this fantastic movie called Rope, which is just the tension in it is palpable. It actually ended up being 5 or 6 takes. But it, you know, got to the point where you realize the actors on screen have been shooting for 18 minutes now. And if any of them makes a mistake, they're going to have to do the whole scene again. And so there is this additional layer of tension. So I love this idea of constraints. You know, let's choose an artificial constraint on what we're allowed to do here. And then working within that constraint, I think that fosters a new kind of creativity. And, you know, esoteric languages are, the rule is it needs to be a way of programming a computer that, you know, runs code. Code you can actually, you can build and you can run and you can build programs with it. But which is trying to do something funny and weird at the same time. There is a very famous one called Brainfuck. BF if you're Googling it at work. And Brainfuck is a language that only has 8 operators, and each one of them is a single punctuation character. So it's like bracket, bracket, less than, greater than. And any program, Alan Turing had this thing called the Universal Turing Machine, which was a hypothetical computer consisting of a state machine and an infinite roll of tape and a head that could move backwards and forwards along this tape, writing ones and zeros and reading them. And what Turing proved is that any problem that can be solved by any computer can be solved with a Turing machine. So we have this idea of the universal Turing machine and Turing compatibility. And you'll sometimes hear people talk about Turing completeness. And Turing completeness basically means it's a language that you can solve any problem that can be solved with computers. So the class of modern programming languages is there's a technical term for this, which I cannot remember, but they are equivalent in terms of the kind of problems they can solve. There are problems we can't solve, which is stuff like, you know, quantum factorization. No existing computer can solve that, but other than some discrepancies in performance, all computers do prime factorization the same way, using the same kind of algorithms that you would be able to run on a Turing machine. So there's this thing, okay, if Turing is to find this thing, what's the smallest set of operators you need in a programming language to be Turing complete? And Brainfuck came along and went, we can do it with 8. Gives you input, output, stack, push and pop, increment, decrement, test, and advance the instruction counter or something. And yeah, you can, any program you can write on a computer, you can write in Brainfuck using 8 pieces of punctuation. So the code is massive and it's completely unreadable because there's no comments, there's nothing. There's just these dots and characters and things. And so there's this class of, so that was one ESO language. It's like, what's the smallest language we can make? There is another one which is called Malbolge, which was deliberately, what is the most impossible, unwieldy, awkward, horrible language we can come up with. It's named after one of the circles of hell in Dante's Inferno. And Malbolge, basically, you're going to need to check the details on this because I don't remember it exactly. But it's something like after every character of the source code, it applies a cipher based on the Enigma machine to the rest of the program. So the source code is actually a constantly rotating cipher. So the same character twice in a Malbolge program does not mean the same thing. It means whatever it means at that point based on how many ciphering encryption routines it's been through to get to that point. There's a thing called Intercal, which is... Intercal is just crazy. Intercal is the only language that has... You know, people talk about go-to, considered harmful. Intercal has a come-from instruction. So like somewhere in a different file, there can be a line that just says, come from here. And so if your program gets here, it's going to go over there, but you can't see that because there's no indication in your code that the come from is targeting that address or that location in the program. Intercal has only one arithmetic operator, which will take two numbers and it will interleave the bits in their bit fields and stuff. But it is still Turing complete. It is apparently possible to translate any program into an Intercal program. So then, as well as the kind of, I guess, the sort of the hardcore esoteric languages like Malbolge and Intercal, there are the poetic ones. There's this language called Shakespeare. And Shakespeare is a stack-based language where the programs read like Shakespeare plays. So the kind of input-output things are stage directions, you know, enter Romeo, enter Juliet. And then if you say nice things about a character, it increments that variable. And if you say negative things about them, it decrements the variable. And there's dialogue between the characters and this kind of stuff. And then there's another language, which is called Chef. And the idea with Chef is that all the programs are actually recipes. They have a lot of programs, like Fibonacci and Chef is something like take 1 million eggs and 8 liters of flour or something. And somebody did actually last year, they tried to write a Chef program, which was actually like a chocolate cake recipe that made sense. So it had sensible quantities and it was not only a valid Chef program, but also if you follow the instructions, you'd end up with cake. And this whole idea kind of started me thinking, because I've always been interested in these kind of things, but never really spent a huge amount of time working with them. And you know about this thing we have in IT called Rockstar developers, which is this whole idea that recruiters put in their adverts, oh, we need to hire a Rockstar developer. And it's been around for years. And it's basically this crap. It's this idea that it's like the 10x developer thing that spiked on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. That there are these amazing superpowered ninjas. And if you get one on your team, they'll just solve all your problems and you'll make $1 million and never need to worry about bugs ever again. Paul Stavell, who runs Octopus Deploy, he put this thing on Twitter last year. He just said somebody should make a programming language called Rockstar so we can all be Rockstar developers. I saw this and I thought about it and I thought somebody's going to do that. And after a week, nobody had done it. And so I thought, what the hell? This could be fun. So I started playing around with, because, you know, the other thing that I do is I do music. I write songs and I play instruments. And I love big hair, heavy metal and glam rock from the 1980s. Bon Jovi and Meat Loaf and Def Leppard, all that kind of stuff. And there's a certain kind of very overblown lyrics that crops up a lot in that kind of music. And I thought, I wonder if we could... I wonder if it is possible to make a programming language that all the programs look like 1980s heavy metal songs. And so I started playing around with these ideas. And, you know, it was kind of funny. I sat in a bar and with my laptop and I just wrote a spec. And it was a joke, you know, we'll throw away, write a specification, stick it out there, maybe get a couple of laughs. And that went kind of viral and got like 5,000 likes on GitHub. And I started getting people filing issues against the spec. And I pinged them back. I was like, why do you care about this ambiguity in a specification that I wrote in a bar? And they said, because my implementation has undefined behavior. And I was like, you're what? And yeah, there were people, 3 or 4 people within a couple of days had implemented Rockstar, this joke language based on Meat Loaf lyrics. And somebody had implemented it in Scala. Somebody had done one in Rust. And I was just blown away that, you know, this had sort of struck a chord with the developer community like this. And I kept thinking, you know, any day now, this thing is just going to die down. And it didn't. It just every couple of weeks, another like pocket of people would stumble across it and share it with one another, and the website hits would go up and I'd get more stars on GitHub. And eventually I started feeling left out because I was like, I want to know how they're doing it. How do you make a compiler for an esoteric language? And so over Christmas, when I had a bit of time off work, I basically dug into, I did compiler theory at university 20 years ago. And, I learned about lexers and parsers. I passed an exam, and then I probably forgot everything I'd ever learned. So I dug out some old textbooks and I found some articles online and started digging through this and discovered a thing called a parsing expression grammar, which is this incredibly powerful tool for matching patterns in your input source file and translating them into data structures and abstract syntax trees. And it was, you know, it was hard work. It was probably 5 or 6 days of completely solid in the zone, you know, constantly doing stuff I'd never, ever kind of had to handle before and learning about parsing theory and prefix notations, all this kind of stuff. But I did it. And I got to a point, I had a JavaScript interpreter that actually ran everything in the Rockstar spec. One thing I will say, if you ever implement a designer specification in a bar as a joke, there will be things that seemed like a really good idea after 2 pints of beer that then when you have to implement it are just horrible and you're thinking, why did we do this? But at this point, you know, other people had already done it. I didn't really want to just start ripping bits of the spec out because they didn't make sense anymore. So I sort of set myself that constraint of, you know, implement sober what you design drunk, as Hemingway would have it. And you know, that was a lot of fun, and it's you know, got a lot of buzz. The whole thing is a massive joke. Someone said to me, why would you program in Rockstar? I'm like, don't really. If you're writing programs to do anything important, Rockstar is not for you. But it's fun. It's lots of fun. It's fun to play around with. I've showed it to people who've, you know, gone away and come back the next day and be like, I was up in my hotel room all night trying to write stuff in Rockstar. What have you done? So clearly there's something in this idea. And the thing that I sort of let's, because we're running out of time a little bit here, but let's wrap up by talking a little bit about the future of all this kind of stuff.
So before we move on to the next thing, for a person who doesn't know what the hell we're talking about, how do you write code in Rockstar to do something, not necessarily useful, but do something?
So let me give you a couple of examples. So one of the classic example is FizzBuzz. So we built a FizzBuzz implementation for it. And just the way you do function syntax in Rockstar, it's all, there's no punctuation, no brackets, no arithmetic and stuff. It's all words. So you have a function name takes argument and then give back result. And then loops are done using like while and assignment is put this into that. So the arithmetic modulus in Rockstar, a function called midnight. Midnight takes your heart and your soul. While your heart is as high as your soul, put your heart without your soul into your heart, give back your heart. And that's it. And you put your heart and your soul are variables. Rockstar variables can have spaces in them, by the way, because that saves us arguing over whether kebab case or Pascal case or camel case or whatever. And then I've got a PR that I'm working on at the moment to add stacks and arrays and lists to it, which, you know, the whole idea of push and pop to push and pop things from a stack. Mm-hmm. It's like, we don't do push and pop, we do rock and roll. So you want to push something into a list, you rock it, and you want to pull something out of a list, you roll it, and you roll it into something. So what I've got here is a function that basically does a string concatenation. So the Reaper takes the fallen, salvation is silence. Silence here means nothing, zero. Until the fallen and nothing, roll the fallen into the fire. Cast the fire into the dark. Let salvation be with the dark. So that's going to take an array of integers, and it's going to coerce each one of them using the cast operator into a string, and then push them, basically. So you end up with, you go from an array of numbers into a string of characters, which is quite important, because sometimes you want to be able to build up particular words without those words appearing in your source code, because the words are not very raw. So we've now got a chunk of code in here. My dreams are diamond nightmares. Your love is meaningless to me. My soul is crying inside. Rock my dreams like a razor blade smile. Rock my dreams with your love, your love. Rock my soul like a switchblade missile. Rock my soul with your love, your love. And what that does is it loads the ASCII codes for FIZZBUZZ into two accumulators that we can then turn into strings to get fizz and buzz. So you can write fizzbuzz without having to write fizzbuzz. This is what I... what
if
I
someone wants to see
time.
This code, is there a particular page I can go to?
So this is on, it's on the Rockstar Lang repository. So the language is all codewithrockstar.com is the website, and there's a little online interpreter there to play around with. And I keep meaning to get around to putting a page on there where people can order stickers and stuff, because the stickers are going down pretty well. But, you know, time.
I know. Is your language Turing complete?
Yes. Very much so. It's so anything you can do with any program, you can do. Actually, IO is a the only way to do any kind of network or file system at the moment is with redirects. But hey, the Turing machine didn't have networking either. So no. It's Turing complete, but there are still some, it doesn't have a module system, it doesn't have networks, it doesn't have file input output. And, you know, these are all kind of ideas that people want this so they can write big programs in it, which worries me slightly. But hey, you know, I guess as long as they're doing it in their spare time and they're all consenting adults, it's absolutely fine. So, and yeah, so the fun part, the thing that idea I have batting around, kind of buzzing around at the moment is there's a couple of language features for Rockstar that I want to get in there. And then I want to really see if it's possible to, I want to run a programming competition. I want to, you know, get a bunch of people to be like, look, this is Rockstar, write your best rock song that's also a valid program. And then get a couple of musicians together, go into a studio and pick like the 10 best ones and actually turn them into real songs. And if it gets to a point where we can put out a album of songs that people who don't know the joke have no idea, they just think that like it's a bad tribute to Meatloaf or something, I'll consider that time very, very well spent. So that's the Rockstar, you know, Rockstar the album or Rockstar the, I don't know what we're going to do with it, but it seems like a fun way to spend some time.
It also seems like the other thing, do at a conference.
Well, yeah, you know, this is, conferences are one of the things I love about, you know, conferences and the role they have in this industry is, you know, they're a great way to learn and meet people, but it's also an opportunity to celebrate the stuff that we do, you know. There historically has not been a huge amount of celebration involved in IT because it tended to be quite a sort of lonely, introverted thing, you know, this trope of somebody sat at home by themselves writing code. And so it's nice getting people together and it's nice, you know, making people laugh and celebrating and enjoying the stuff that we all do. So anything I can do to be part of that, I'm a big fan of. And of course, now you can get endorsed for Rockstar on LinkedIn. So when you get all of those sweet Rockstar jobs come up in your feed, you can be like, yep, I am a Rockstar developer. And with any luck, in a year, the recruitment industry will stop talking about Rockstars altogether, and we can all get on with our lives.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the day, Dylan?
Probably just to say I'm going to be out on the road again. I take the summer off, so August I'm not traveling, no conferences. End of August, I'm literally off, going to be off the grid for a week or two. But then September, October, November, I'm going to be doing a bunch of stuff all over the world. It'd be lovely to, you know, see people come up and say hello and let's talk about Rockstar and Quines and all this kind of stuff. So middle of September, 11th, 12th, and 13th is ProgNet, what used to be the Progressive.net workshops, which is at Skills Matter in London. Check that out at prognet.io. 2 days of deep dive workshops all about, you know, .NET, Entity Framework, .NET Core, new gRPC stuff. Really, really cool conference. I'm on the program committee for that one, have been for many years, and I'll be hosting some stuff there as well. I'm going to be end of September at a DevConf in Krakow in Poland. Week after that, I'm going to be I'm doing a secret thing I'm not allowed to tell you about yet, but it's going to be on the 3rd of October in Copenhagen, so watch out for announcements there. And then Umbraco Festival on the 11th of October, and looking at my calendar like this, crazy. Week after that, I'm at Kandinsky, Marco Heimshoff's thing in Berlin. Week after that is DDD East Midlands at Nottingham here in the UK, which is, check that out, ddeastmidlands.com. We're also doing PubConf after that, which is 5-minute funny lightning talks from lots of the speakers with booze and music and food, and that should be awesome. Announcement about that coming up soon. And then I think I'm in Romania after that. And then November, as is traditional, will be Build Stuff in Lithuania. And we're going back to Kiev this year as well. And I think that takes us through to the end of the year. And then we get to take a break for Christmas and do it all over again. Good times.
Indeed. Well, Dylan Beattie, thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Brian. It's been delightful. Take care.
If you liked this episode, you might also like episodes 124 and 65 with Mads Torgersen on C# 8 and 7. Thank you. The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Fizzbuzz, performed by Dylan Beattie.